Oh, I'm very happy to be with you again. My memories of my last time with you are colored by the sobering providence that occurred that Sunday morning that some of you will remember when that man was found dead, and that quite properly focused our minds a good part of that day. But for that time and the other opportunities of the last visit, I'm very thankful and glad to be with you again. I did not bring my Africa shirt this time. Some of you will remember that I wore a very colorful shirt in the evening meeting, I recently wore that on a Lord's Day evening to preach in Melbourne, North Carolina, and I told the people when I got up that I was wearing that shirt because I knew that when Pastor Hendricks goes to Africa with me, that he'll come back with a whole suitcase full of colorful shirts like that. So I was breaking them in to the and. Pastor Hendricks will not be going to Africa with me, by the way. Pastor Hendricks no longer flies. I don't know whether you know that about my dear friend, but he will only go where his cars will take him. But thank you so much for your generous financial help in what I'm doing and for your prayers. I'm thankful to say that those prayers are being answered. I remember many times sitting in a meeting like this and some missionary getting up and talking about how important prayer was for what he was doing. And I confess that I would sometimes not have the most godly response to those kinds of statements and probably thought, you want us to pray, but you want money. Too, don't you? I really do feel ashamed now when I look back on those thoughts, because when you're thousands and thousands of miles from home and in a strange place and all alone and are uncertain as to what's going to be happening the next hour or the next half day, believe me, it does intensify your felt sense of need. And elevates gratitude for every prayer that's offered. So thank you so much for praying. Let me begin with some points of clarity for me, maybe added clarity since I was with you 10 months ago. There are two or three things that have now settled in my mind and spirit, and one of those is that my dear wife, it's clear to me, is not going to make any kind of transition to live in East Africa. I might not have said this when I was here 10 months ago because she was with me, but when I first started going to East Africa to teach pastors, I was so drawn and I was so aware of the need and the opportunities that I had some desires that my wife would go along on a trip, and then when we came back home, she would say, "Randy, we just have to go to East Africa for the next 3 years and live in Nairobi or live in Kampala." I realized the last time Julie was with me, last July, that's not going to happen. There's no reason for me to anticipate that happening. And my dear wife is very supportive of what I'm doing. She makes sacrifices for me to be gone as much as I'm now away from her. Julie has thrown her whole heart into all 41 years of my pastoral efforts here in the States. And she's not going to make the transition to live in Nairobi or Kampala for 2 or 3 years. So I'm settled and satisfied, thankful, to simply plan to go as much as I can and teach as much as I can as God continues to open doors. By the way, there's a particular method I now have to underscore to African pastors the priority of their marriage over ministry. I soon learned after I started going to East Africa that the common attitude among pastors was, you know, to have this vision of going to a certain village to evangelize, and it was very common for men to say, well, sweetheart, however they say sweetheart, I'm going to be gone for the next 3 weeks, and pray and trust God to provide food for you and the children. I'm sure he will while I go evangelize. And that kind of attitude, that assumption, you know, this is my calling, so it must take priority over everything, has to be addressed. It needs to be addressed. And so one of the ways that I've been doing that is that in talking sometimes about my wife or about my marriage, I will say to pastors, by the way, brothers, when I go home in a few weeks, if my wife looks at me and says, Randy, I can't do this anymore, you know, we just can't have these lengthy separations, I'm done with this, I say to these men, I won't be back. Well, that's shocking to them, you know. But it's a very concrete way for me to say the obligations that the Bible gives you as a Christian husband take priority over the felt burdens that you may have for ministry. And so I thank God for my wife at many, many, many levels, even as a way of underscoring a principle to African pastors. Secondly, I have continued to pursue what I think I mentioned to you when I was here 10 months ago, and that is to focus on smaller numbers of pastors, and God willing, gathering the same pastors in the same places twice a year, if possible, three times a year, and planning, God willing, to do that over the next 7 or so years. I'm now into my third year of doing this, and I had desires for 10 years when I started, and so if the Lord gives me another 6, I'll be very thankful. I'm connected, as most of you know, to an organization called Equipping Pastors International. It was started by a PCA minister, and most of the people who've worked with Equipping Pastors International have been PCA folks, Presbyterian Church of America. But they're not distinctly Presbyterian, and they're quite happy to have a Baptist among them. And most of the folks that have been going and teaching with EPI have gone to lots of different places, gathered very large numbers of pastors, 600, 700, 800 in one place, and have given those large numbers very basic material about the church or about marriage, and that's very good. I'm not at all opposed to that. I gladly affirm that as a profitable thing. But it became clear to me that if I have any reasonable hope of some lasting influence and some ongoing good of some level of reformation among African churches, that I needed to concentrate on smaller numbers of men and teach those same men as much as possible, and where possible, to do that in English. And I've now made that transition in Kenya. I teach in a city outside of Nairobi called Moranga. It's about 50 kilometers outside of Nairobi. And the first time I went to Moranga, I taught 200 pastors. The second time I taught, 50 pastors. And in March, my last time there, March of this year, I taught 15 pastors and taught them in English. And those men were convinced that that was a better way for us to go. And so if under the blessing of God, there can be four or five men in eight or nine places 10 years from now who are on their way theologically and biblically and can then teach other pastors, if the Lord blesses my efforts to that extent, I'll be very happy. And then it has become more clear to me that I need to maintain a fairly narrow focus of what I teach. I'm convinced that most African pastors need clarity, need biblical understanding about how God saves sinners, about how the Christian life must be lived, and what the struggles of a normal Christian life are, and how to respond to those struggles. And so I rarely get into the details of ecclesiology. I rarely start teaching about very specific matters of church government and so forth. Recently, when I was in Mebane, I made the comment, I said, some of you young guys here in Mebane who want to be involved in missions, you can straighten out the ecclesiology, you know, 10 years from now when you go, and I'll get them started on a healthy path. That may be a little bit of a cop-out on my part. Those are some things that have become more clear to me. And then let me give you a huge statistic and a huge fact. A huge statistic and a huge fact. I probably gave you this statistic when I was here last, but it's important enough that I don't have any discomfort in repeating it. In sub-Sahara Africa, in other words, below North Africa, where Islam dominates, in sub-Sahara Africa, East Africa, Central Africa, West Africa, Southern Africa, those four sections that make up sub-Sahara Africa, the evangelical community, that is, everybody that says Jesus is the Son of God, the Bible is the Word of God, you have to be born again to escape hell and go to heaven, and Jesus is the only way. The people that believe that, believe those basic things, that community, that group of people, grows by about 200,000 people every 10 days. Now, that doesn't mean, listen carefully, that doesn't mean that 200,000 people are genuinely converted every 10 days. If that happened, then Africa would be transformed in 2 years, and they would be sending many preachers to us, right? Or sending them somewhere, sending them to the Muslim world. I'm sure that statistic comes out of a very broad definition of response to the gospel. It's everybody that makes any kind of response to some kind of presentation of the gospel. And probably a lot of those people were converted for the fourth time. Okay? So, I mean, all kinds of qualifications would have to be given to that statistic. But it is still a huge number of people making some kind of response to some kind of presentation of the Christian message. Now, what is most significant for me is that 90% of those people will end up in churches where pastors have no training. I mean zero. Zip. I'm not talking about pastors who are well-trained. I'm talking about any kind of training. I've been in churches. I've been in rural African churches where a man was chosen to be pastor because he could read the Bible. because he was the only man in the church who could read. He was the only man in a church that could stand up and read the scriptures to the congregation when they gathered. You say, well, that's not adequate qualifications for a man to be a pastor. No, that's way, way below the qualifications that a man should have to be a pastor. But that's what literally happens in some places. Well, that's the huge statistic. But along with that statistic, there's a huge fact that has become more and more evident to me as I keep going to East Africa, and that is that Islam is growing. Islam is growing in Uganda. Islam is growing in Kenya. You probably heard that Al-Shabaab carried out another attack 2 or 3 days ago in Nairobi. In September, when Al-Shabaab took over that upscale shopping mall, remember that? They went in on a Saturday afternoon and started gunning people down and captured this large upscale mall in Nairobi, and I think held that mall for 4 or 5 days. I was in Kenya when that happened. I was out in Muranga, about 50 kilometers outside of Nairobi, when that attack took place. I had finished teaching, and I was getting some rest on a Saturday, preaching in a couple of churches on that Lord's Day, and scheduled to fly out of Nairobi on the Monday. And so the Saturday, when I'm getting some rest at my hotel, all of Kenya was focused on that attack. And the mall was still under siege when I left the country. In Uganda, Muslims have a goal of building a mosque every 15 kilometers. Now, you mathematicians, 15 kilometers, 10 miles, 10 or 12 miles, 9 miles, okay. And they're doing it. I mean, there's evidence that they're actually accomplishing this. And in some of those places, some of the small Ugandan towns, a mosque has been built where there are yet no Muslims. But Muslims assume there will be Muslims. And so huge amounts of money are being spent. In many small Ugandan towns, when you drive through the town, the newest building and the most attractive building in the town will be the mosque. It stands out like a bright sign. It just you can't miss it as you drive through a typical African village. A huge statistic: the evangelical community growing extraordinarily without adequate leadership, and Islam advancing as well. And I do not have great expectations for the East African church or for the Sub-Sahara African church unless able leadership is raised up. And believe me, folks, I am only throwing in a few drops of water, you know, into this huge, huge lake of spiritual activity, but let me pause here to tell you a frustration that I feel. When I went to Roanoke, Virginia, in 1978, to be a pastor with a friend in a church called Grace Church, there were probably 3 churches in the Roanoke Valley where you could hear God really is God. He saves people by his electing grace. And when he saves people by his electing grace, their lives are changed. Now, that's pretty good. I mean, thank God. God really is God. He saves people by his electing grace, and when he does it, They're different. You could have heard that in probably three churches. Today, you can hear that preached effectively and faithfully in 25 or 30 churches in the Roanoke Valley, where I live. It's amazing. There have been times when I've said, Lord, why do you keep sending gifted young men to the... I mean, you know, what it is... You know, is God going to... I mean, I've asked at times, is God going to save huge numbers of people in Roanoke? It'd be wonderful. But there's a part of me that looks at that and says, hey, guys, we don't need 25 churches like you have. 10 of you should come with me and start teaching pastors in other parts of the world, and then some of these churches maybe could get together. That's a real frustration that I feel. Now, you know, I haven't had anybody volunteer, and no pastor has resigned his church and call me up and say, hey, Brother Andy, I'm recruited, man. Take me the next time you go. That hasn't happened, but, okay, some people and situations that I want to share with you and ask your prayers. I know you've seen the name if you've looked at my letters. Several times you would have seen the name Joel Mukalu. Joel Mukalu has been the bishop of the PAG denomination, Pentecostal Assemblies of God. He's been the bishop of the PAG group in Lira, Uganda, for the last 6 or 7 years. Lira is one district of Uganda. It's in northern Uganda. And there are about 700 churches in that one group in that one district. And the first time I went to Lira, I taught all the pastors. I taught about 800 pastors first time I went. And then we reduced it to all the lead pastors. I say lead pastors because this denomination basically has an Episcopal government. Their church government is broadly Episcopal. So you have a bishop, and then you have lead pastors, and they have 5 or 6 small congregations under them. And Joel Mukalu is the bishop of that whole group of churches. And his wife's name is Grace. And they have become dear to me, and I love them. But Joel is being opposed by the national leadership of his denomination. And the reason he's being opposed to remain the leader in Lira, the reason he's being opposed is because the national leaders of that group started encouraging bishops to get behind political candidates, to align themselves with particular political candidates and parties, and Bishop Joel refused. Thank God, refused. But that put him in disfavor of national leaders, and they've been trying to get rid of him. When I was there early April, some of that was coming to a head, and how I should give counsel, what kind of counsel I should give, it's a very difficult situation. But God has given me a relationship, a real friendship, and I feel responsible to give godly counsel, and I need the Lord's wisdom. Let me give you the name George Kariuki. K-A-R-I-U-K-I, Kariuki. George Kariuki is the Kenyan pastor out in that place, Moranga. And he's the man that brought together the 15 pastors that I taught in March. And I see these men in Kenya really making progress theologically. I'm encouraged with the way they're responding. I see myself spending a lot of time in Morang over the next few years. I think I've told you about a man named Noah Mudagiri. The first time I met Noah was in Rwanda. I'd gone to Kigali, Rwanda, that's the capital of Rwanda. I'd gone, this was my first time to go to Kigali. And when I walked into this church to meet these Rwandan pastors for the first time, up front, in the front of the meeting room, there were three chairs. And then the other chairs were kind of spread out around the three front chairs. Well, in those three front chairs were three older men. And the middle of the three was Bishop Noah, okay? And these three men are dressed, you know, they have suits on and dress shirts and ties, and it's younger men are, and it became obvious to me that these older men, they're going to give me this or they're going to give me this. And if they give me this, forget it. You know, pack up and go someplace else. Have I told you this story before? Okay. You know, see, at my age, you don't remember. Well, during the time I was teaching that group of men, in one, I forget what connection, I have no memory of what led me to say this. But I said, you know, brothers, there are times when my Bible reading becomes really stale to me. And I said, now I'm not talking about studying for sermons. I'm talking about just reading the Bible as a Christian believer for my own soul. And I said, there are times when it becomes stale to me. I'm not enjoying it. And I said, I'm going to tell you what I do at those times. I go to one of the Gospels. I take Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John, and I'll spend two or three days just reading the gospel. And I said, getting my mind and heart directly in contact with Jesus, with who he was, what he said, what he did, it quickens my heart. And then I go back, and I just moved on. You know, I just kind of threw it out as something that I've struggled with in my Christian life. And after that session, Bishop Noah came to me, and he grabbed my hands, and he said, I've struggled with that very problem in my own Christian life for years, and I've always been afraid to tell anyone, and I haven't known what to do, and it just, you know, it bound that man's heart to me. I mean, it was amazing. I could have never planned or envisioned. It was just something the Lord did. And so from that point on, Bishop Noah wants me to teach as many pastors as I possibly can. And he spent most of his life in he's Congolese. He was born and reared in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And he was involved in planting hundreds of churches, literally hundreds of churches in the DRC and in Burundi. But I met him in Kigali because some of his family had moved to Kigali, and there were needs in his extended family, and he was in his mid to late 70s, and so he retired. He said, I'm going to retire. So he leaves the DRC, leaves Burundi, moves to Rwanda. He lives there now. But he still travels often back to the DRC, back to Burundi. So when I saw Bishop Noah in September, uh, he he came to me and he said, would you please go back to Burundi? I'd been to Burundi once before, and it had not been a positive experience. It had been very difficult. And I'll tell you why, because there are times when African men have been put in leadership in churches where they have no business being in leadership. But they assume, because I'm a leader, I'm supposed to know a lot. I'm supposed to be a knowledgeable, mature man, because, well, they're not. I mean, some of these men, the ignorance is, it's very sad. And occasionally I'll find myself in a situation where men come and they're not teachable. They come assuming I'm Bishop so-and-so or I'm Pastor so-and-so, and so I understand what I'm supposed to understand, and their hearts aren't open. And that had happened in Burundi, my first time there. And so when I left, I thought, well, hey, there's plenty of places I can go, and I don't have to come back here. But in September, Bishop Noah came to me and pleaded with me, please, please, would you go back to Burundi? Well, I told him that I would, and I was there in February. And it was still not the most encouraging situation I've ever been in, but it was better. It was better. And at the end of that trip, this was, forgive me, this was January, February. The last day I was there, it was the Lord's Day, I was taken to a church to preach. And the man that was taking me, I thought he said that that it was a Wesleyan church. I thought that's what the man had told me, that I was going to preach in a Wesleyan church. But I'm picked up at my hotel, and I've got all my stuff packed because I'm catching a plane late that night to head back to the States, and I'm taken way across Bujumbura. That's the capital of Burundi, Bujumbura. I'm driven way across Bujumbura, and we pull up in front of this church, and here's a big sign that says Central Presbyterian Church. And the pastor is, his first name is Francois, and forgive me, I can't remember his family name, but Pastor Francois, and he welcomes me. I preached to about 500 people at Central Presbyterian Church, and then I go to dinner with Pastor Francois and some other leaders after church, so I say to Pastor Francois, what Presbyterian group are you connected to? He said, we're not connected to a group. And I said, well, your church is Presbyterian. You're supposed to be part of a group. Well, he said, we're not Presbyterians like that. And here's the story. This dear man, he's Congolese. He was born and reared in the DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo. And he went to some kind of Bible school in the DRC, and one of the professors in this Bible school was honest enough in a class at some point to say, hey, there's this thing called Calvinism that has been around for a long time, and there are people that believe this stuff called Calvinism, and the man gives a definition. He tells the class. He tells the class. So Pastor Francois, he's sitting there in the class, and it sounds very appealing to him, and he starts reading his Bible, with that in mind, and before long he realizes that's what the Bible teaches, So 12 years ago, there's an end to this story, okay? 12 years ago, he leaves the DRC to go to Bujumbura to plant a church. I mean, he goes into an area where there's no church, starts preaching, witnessing, and established this church. And he had assumed that he was a Presbyterian, because he believed this stuff called Calvinism that had been believed in church history, and those people are Presbyterians. So he assumed that's what I am. So his church was named Central Presbyterian Church. And he told me that the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, probably Dr. Krabbendam, David, had something to do with this. The Orthodox Presbyterian Church, not too long ago, had sent a man to visit him, you know, to visit their church. And the man had said, well, now, you know, if you become a part of our church, you have to baptize babies. And Pastor Francois said, oh, no, the Bible doesn't teach that. We're not going to do that. And then this OP brother said, and these people dancing during the service, you have to stop that. No, we can't stop that, because the Bible does talk about that a little bit, you know. So I said to Pastor Francois, I think you're a Reformed Baptist. And I said, there's actually a lot of these people back in the United States. Well, he said, I'd like to meet some of them sometime. I've now communicated with Bishop Noah, okay, the older man that has become so dear to me and that I love so much. I've now communicated with him about connecting his desires with Pastor Francois. So I'm hoping that the Lord will enable me to organize things in Burundi in a healthier way. It's not going to be easy, but I'm hoping that will happen. Let me come to. How much time do I have? By the way, can someone loan me a watch? Oh, there. Oh, there. What time? What?
We have about
10
more minutes.
About 10 more minutes. Okay. Let me quickly. God willing, I'll be going to the Democratic Republic of Congo, and by the way, you can't. Technically, you can't say Congo, because there's a separate country that's called Congo. And the Democratic Republic of Congo is the big country that sits right in the middle of the African continent. And God willing, I'll be going back there in July to teach pastors and to be with a young man that I've come to be closely connected to. His name is Upoki Bitum, and Upoki lives in Bunya, DRC. He's evangelizing a tribe of pygmies right now. Very demanding sacrificial work that he's doing. But tomorrow morning, God willing, I'm going to leave the Davies house very early and go down to D.C. and find my way again to the embassy of the Democratic Republic of Congo, because they have to give me a visa there. Most East African countries, you fly into the airport, you go to, you know, a booth of some kind at the airport, you pay $50 or $75, sometimes $100. That's the most I've ever paid for a temporary visa. Have you ever had higher than $100, David? Okay. let's see, Tanzania charges $100.
I haven't been there.
Okay. Yeah, Tanzania, it's $100. Most places, $50. Kenya's $50. Uganda's $50. But the DRC, you have to have the visa given by the embassy here before you go. So I'll be, God willing, showing up tomorrow. And I have gotten to know Mr. Bushanga, Secretary Bushanga at the DRC embassy. I've engaged in some sanctified, I started to say manipulation, but that's an oxymoron, isn't it? Some sanctified conditioning. So I sent Mr. Bushanga a $50 Starbucks gift card recently. to thank him, for the help that he's given me. And so I will smile. I will smile at him tomorrow morning, God willing. And then I very much need ongoing wisdom about Lyra. I need your prayers as to how to get, how to use money. I'm sure David is aware of this. There are a lot of godly people. I mean, Christian people who are examples to me, who would say, "Don't ever give Africans money. Just don't do it. It's bad. The results of it will be negative. No money given." I don't know that those people are wrong. I'm certainly not going to accuse them of being unloving, but I have not been able to do that. I have not been able to go and see all of the need, the indescribable need, and not give anything. And so usually when I go, I take $400 or $500 with me, intending to ask God to guide me and to carefully, thoughtfully give a little bit of help to a few people. And it's usually a pastor. It's usually a pastor that I've come to know. But I'm telling you folks how to use resources. What really is the path of wisdom? I had an OP, an Orthodox Presbyterian minister, recently say to me that he was having to mediate between two OP missionaries who were butting heads on the field, and they're in East Africa, two OP missionaries butting heads over whether to give people money. And one of them was saying, "Don't ever do it." And the other, a younger man, was saying, "No, we must be compassionate. We cannot put aside." And I, my friend who told me about this, I said, I would not know what to say to them. I wouldn't know what to say if I was sitting with both of them right now. But for me, I have not been able to. Now, you have to shut down most things. Because human needs are staring in the face everywhere you look. Everywhere. And so most of it, you have to shut off. But it's hard. And then I have been given a green light from Equipping Pastors International to start recruiting some other pastors to go to a few places. And let me tell you about one of them. In January, I went way up in northern Uganda to a city called Gulu, G-U-L-U, Gulu. And Gulu was the place where Joseph Kony started his civil war. You've probably heard the name Joseph Kony. He was the man that would capture children from families and turn them into soldiers. Gulu is where Joseph Kony started his civil war. Now, he's been driven out of Uganda. We're not even sure where he is now. As far as we know, he's alive. Our military recently sent about 100 Marines to help in the search for Joseph Kony. I assumed when I was in Gulu that at the end, the pastors were going to say, when can you come back? And I knew if they asked that, I would have to tell them, I cannot promise you that I'll come back. Because I feel like I've made all the commitments in Uganda that I should make. And so, sure enough, in January, after I taught in Gulu, these pastors said, when can you come again? And I said, brothers, I'm sorry, but I can't tell you that I'll come back. I'm about maxed out. Well, I've now been given a green light to recruit some other pastors, and I've asked Pastor George McDearman if he will go to Gulu with me. sometime later this year. Now, he's not even giving me an answer, yes or no. But I would love to take Pastor McDearman to Gulu and introduce him to these men. That's all I'd be able to do. I wouldn't be able to, you know, I could make one visit with him, and then it'd be up to him as to whether he wanted to keep going. And I told him he doesn't have to make up his mind until after he's been there. So Melissa, if you can put some pressure on Pastor McDearman in some appropriate way. Is my time gone? My time's gone. I'm sorry I blabbed on so.
If I'm counting right, at least five countries, Kenya, Uganda, Rwanda, Burundi. And the Democratic Republic of Congo. Many opportunities.
Five countries, and I've been to Tanzania, but the man that I was connected to in Tanzania, I've backed off, and I've not said anything about the man to anyone. I have no desire to injure him or to hinder what he's doing, but for myself, I backed off. So I'd still like to have a contact and one place in Tanzania.
Brother Chuck, could I ask